From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
After the devastation wrought by Hurricane Helene, President Biden paid a supportive visit to storm-tossed Taylor County.
I want you to know, I see you, I hear you, I grieve with you, and I promise you we have your back.
Also this week, but not everyone believed what actually happened during this year's hurricane season.
Claims that the hurricanes were a result of weather modification or that the government is controlling the weather somehow.
We'll also speak with some recognized experts when it comes to such changes as climate change, and we'll celebrate the golden victory of a young Florida athlete. I'm Tom Flanagan. Our Capitol reporters have picked their favorite stories from the past year. We'll hear them all in the course of this edition of Capitol Report. ...2024 was expected to be a bad year for hurricanes, but for a particular part of North Florida, the year was worse than bad. Adrian Andrews covered Hurricanes Helene and the two storms that preceded it, Idalia and Debby.
September 26th, that's the day Keaton Beach and Perry had its third hurricane in 13 months. Local residents are using words like devastated and heartbroken to describe how they're feeling.
Coming home to seeing it gone.
Joe Gus is a Keaton Beach homeowner. His house sat just a few feet from the Gulf waters. The storm ripped the three-bedroom home from its foundation. Joe told WFSU he remains hopeful that his insurance company will pick up most of the bill, but it's the thought of losing precious memorabilia in the storm that breaks his heart.
Basically how they say, you flip your house upside down, whatever comes out, it's not insured. So all this is just money and time wasted.
Since the storm, Florida officials have been on the ground working to restore power and bring food and supplies to the area. One humanitarian group from Missouri, Convoy of Hope, brought in supplies to distribute to Perry storm victims. Ethan Forges is the organization's spokesperson.
We're getting them cases of water, sports drinks, hygiene items that they may need, all those sorts of things that you and I take for granted on a daily basis.
Governor Ron DeSantis has visited Taylor County on multiple occasions, prioritizing power restoration and search and rescue. Most of those efforts have been completed, but devastation remains. President Joe Biden recently flew into Taylor, touring part of Keaton Beach and speaking with residents about ongoing recovery efforts. The Biden administration has vowed to get Perry storm victims federal aid so that they can start rebuilding. Biden has also deployed troops to the Big Bend to help distribute food, water, and other essential items.
I want you to know, I see you, I hear you, I grieve with you, and I promise you we have your back. We're going to stay until you're restored.
Last year's Hurricane Idalia was the first storm to hit Florida's Big Bend in some years, followed by Hurricane Debby and now Helene in the span of 2 months. Taylor County's Emergency Management Officer Andrew Morgan says each storm, in a way, brought the community closer. But he's not sure just how much more Taylor County can take.
Now we got to just pretty much pull our muscles out and do it again. That's the only thing you really can do at this point.
I'm Adrian Andrews.
But the 2024 hurricane season had an unexpected sidebar when it came to the reaction of what seemed to be a growing segment of the public. Tristan Wood examined the sudden surge of conspiracy theories when it came to the storms and their aftermath.
The conspiracy theories have a major theme: that the disasters are power grabs by the government. Sarah Swan, a staff writer with PolitiFact, has been working to debunk those false claims.
So PolitiFact has seen two major false narratives. One is that Hurricane Helene and Hurricane Milton were created through weather modification or otherwise planned. The other is that FEMA, which is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, their disaster assistance is not as it appears. Some viral social media posts have claimed that $750 payments from FEMA are loans that need to be paid back.
The payments to eligible individuals do not need to be paid back and are a minimum of $750. As for the weather, it is possible for individual clouds to be manipulated and rainfall to be induced. But Jeff Chanton, a Florida State University oceanologist and climatologist, says the technology to influence the climate of an entire region does not exist, and there are no tools that allow the government or anyone else to generate a Category 5 hurricane.
If we could control the weather here in Florida, it would be 78 degrees every day and sunny. And so I wish we could control the weather, but you know, we're not even close to that. We can't even think about that. It's just insane to be spreading that rumor.
But that spread of misinformation isn't new. PolitiFact Swan says those narratives pop up during most natural disasters. This time, she believes the widespread damage of these storms has made the conspiracy spread wider.
We've seen known misinformers like Alex Jones and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene both kind of spread these claims that the hurricanes were a result of weather modification or that the government is controlling the weather somehow.
The misinformation has also led to a misunderstanding on how emergency response efforts work. False social media posts are spreading the idea that the federal government comes into a local disaster area and takes over. But as U.S. Department of Defense spokesperson Sabrina Singh says, the truth is that local and state governments take the lead.
The state knows best what it needs for its communities. They ultimately have, you know, quite literally the maps of their entire communities, cities, and towns. So when there is a response needed from the federal government, or in this case, when you need active duty personnel to flow into a situation, we flow in under the state.
The spread of misinformation has led to strong rebukes from several government officials, including Governor Ron DeSantis. He believes people spreading the misinformation are doing so for personal gain.
Be careful about the nonsense that gets circulated, and just know that the more titillating it is, the more likely somebody is making money off of it, and they don't really give a damn about the well-being and safety of the people that are actually in the eye of this storm. It's all just trying to monetize what they're doing.
And it's not harmless fun, says Swan. The reporter says misinformation can lead to people being fearful of those who are trying to help them.
Federal, state, and local officials have said that these false claims can cause confusion and hinder emergency response efforts, and people living in areas affected by these disasters may be discouraged from seeking help because of this misinformation.
Members of the public can submit questions about disaster response rumors and read debunkings of those common conspiracies on FEMA's website. I'm Tristan Wood.
Coming up on Capitol Report, a Florida climate expert explains why hurricanes are getting stronger.
Our industrial respiration releases CO2 through the process of burning fossil fuels. That waste is dumped into the atmosphere for free. It's not cleaned up whatsoever.
Florida says goodbye to a former governor and U.S. senator. Famed political analyst Susan McManus remembers Bob Graham.
He picked jobs that people wouldn't think a politician at his level would do. And yet that's what endeared him so much.
And a Florida State University swimmer finally got to represent Team USA this year at the Paralympics and found a chance to use her voice.
Christy, the Paralympian, can, you know, raise awareness for other people who are going through things.
As we heard a few minutes ago in that Adrian Andrews piece, large swaths of Florida are still dealing with the aftermath of multiple direct hits from major hurricanes this season. Storms that moved into the hot Gulf of Mexico intensified quickly. Gina Jordan talked about that with Dr. Jeff Chanton. He's a distinguished professor at Florida State University, specializing in oceanography and environmental science.
We've been warned about the hot waters in the Gulf now for at least a few years. Is that high temperature something that you think we can expect to be around for a while in the Gulf?
Well, we continue to burn fossil fuels. The carbon dioxide concentration back in the 1800s, which wasn't that long ago, was 280 parts per million. It's now 420 parts per million. And even back 100 years ago, there was an excellent scientist called Arrhenius who was concerned about the excess CO2 in the atmosphere that was brought about by the Industrial Revolution and the burning of coal, that this would heat the planet and warm the Earth. And CO2 intercepts infrared radiation that the Earth radiates back to space and traps it at the surface of the Earth. And that causes the Earth to warm up. And so this is all well-known science. Excess CO2, excess methane, excess freons in the atmosphere trap heat, infrared radiation. They warm the Earth like a blanket. Mm-hmm. And so when the Earth warms, a lot of that heat, most of it, in fact, is stored in the oceans because the oceans are a heat sink. Warmer oceans result in stronger hurricanes. And, you know, more radiation comes into the Earth at the equator. And the oceans, the currents, and the winds transport heat from the equator poleward. And hurricanes are agents of this poleward heat transfer. So as more heat gets trapped on the Earth, these hurricanes are going to be transporting more heat poleward. That's just what they do. They always form near the equator, and they always move to the north or the south, depending on which hemisphere they're in.
Can you address cyclical climate change versus man-made climate change, or are they working together?
Well, in the Pleistocene, we were in a cyclical climate change. We had these glacial and interglacial cycles, and the Earth's climate went from glacial periods to interglacials. And coincident with that, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere went from 180 during the glacial periods to 280 during the interglacials. And during this last interglacial, the Holocene, humans developed this industrial capacity, which was brought about by fossil fuel burning. And we started to burn coal in England, and then we found oil, we found natural gas, and we've been exploiting these fossil fuels to make our lives better and more comfortable. And that's wonderful. But the issue is that all these heat-trapping gases have been released to the atmosphere, and they warm the planet. So, for example, I always tell my classes this. We have on the Earth the lithosphere, the solid Earth, the hydrosphere, the ocean, and the atmosphere. And when we put our waste into the lithosphere in a landfill, we put our garbage on the side of the road, they come pick it up, they treat it responsibly, and they bury it in a sanitary landfill. We pay for that. When we have liquid waste, we flush our commodes. That liquid waste goes to a central processing plant or to a septic tank, and it's treated and released to the environment after it's cleaned up. But when we dump our waste into the atmosphere, there's no charge for that. And I'm saying that CO2 is a waste product of our industrial respiration. We burn fossil fuels to get energy, just like we burn food to get energy. And we release CO2 through our breath, and our industrial respiration releases CO2 through the process of burning fossil fuels. That waste is dumped into the atmosphere for free. It's not cleaned up whatsoever. And the atmosphere is the most sensitive of these three spheres. It's very dilute. It has a very low density. And so it's very easy to change. And indeed, we have changed it. So the cyclical climate that we had in the Pleistocene, where we're going through these glacial and interglacial cycles, we've left that period behind, because the CO2 now is 420. We haven't experienced that for millions of years, and we're heading back to a climate like, for example, in the Cretaceous, where everything was warm. There were no ice caps anywhere on the Earth. The CO2 then was 1,200. By the end of 2100, by the year 2100, we're going to be at 700 parts per million. That's halfway back to the Cretaceous period. And so we're on a trajectory of change.
And for those who would say that it's arrogant to think that man has that much control over the planet, what would you say?
Humans are a geological force, just like volcanoes. We have released so much carbon dioxide. It's a giant experiment. We have transferred carbon from the lithosphere, from the solid Earth, to the atmosphere. And that's a geological process.
Mm-hmm. Well, state leaders don't like to talk about this, And Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill in May that removes references to climate change in state policy. Can you offer some analysis on that?
It's frightening to me that they would try to hide from this problem. And I don't really understand why. It just seems so obvious that this is happening. I just can't understand it at all.
That was FSU professor Jeff Chanton talking with Gina Jordan about more intense hurricane seasons. Bob Graham transcended party. He was the governor of Florida for two terms and its U.S. senator for three. He was a moderate Democrat whose signature issues were education, the environment, and national security. But his greatest legacy might be in the hearts of ordinary Floridians. Graham died April 16, 2024, at the age of 87, and Margie Menzel has this remembrance.
Senator Graham, first of all, I called mostly to say thank you for your many years of public service in such a dedicated fashion.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Senator Graham, I truly appreciate your dedication and admire and appreciate all of your hard work for the students of Florida.
Thank you.
That's Graham talking with members of the public back in 2007 on a WFSU call-in show called Florida on the Line.
Hey, Senator Graham, you're one of my biggest heroes. I was born in Jacksonville, and I've always admired you a great deal.
Well, thank you, John. Where do you live now?
I work at the University of Florida. I live in Gainesville.
Okay.
And I'm
how are the how are the Gators doing after Saturday night?
Let's not talk about that.
Okay.
That's too painful.
Graham took questions about public policy and brainstormed with callers about how to make the state better.
He was a Harvard-educated guy. He was absolutely one of the most brilliant human beings I've ever met in my life. But he also, despite kind of coming from a very, you know, frankly, elite background and all this, he was incredibly relatable.
Steve Shale is a Democratic strategist and Graham's longtime friend.
And it was because of those experiences with people. And he loved to tell those stories. And he loved seeing people that he had met. He remembered them. And it was a core part of who he was.
Graham is well known for his 400-plus workdays. He started them as a state senator after speaking to a group of teachers about what he saw as the problems in teaching civics. A woman named Sue Riley told him she was sick of politicians telling teachers what to do and challenged him to try it himself. He did. His workdays came to include stints as a deputy sheriff, a busboy, a trucker, a garbage collector, a nursing home attendant, a steel worker, a tomato picker, and a bank teller. Political scientist Susan McManus says her students were most impressed by the fact that Graham worked the whole 8 hours of the workday, not just the photo op.
And he picked jobs that people wouldn't think a politician at his level would do. And yet that's what endeared him so much to everyday people. Again, now we see so many stories about the distance between people in office and their constituents. Gone is the personal touch. And he certainly had that.
The workdays also taught him how people's lives could be bettered by public policy. As a parking attendant, for instance, he learned that lowering the height of a curb could make life much easier for people with disabilities. McManus says Graham used the days as a chance to really get to know his constituents.
And by the time he left, if he were working in a restaurant, by the time he left the establishment, he would know every single person's name that worked there, something about them personally, their family, and also a little bit about what they did at the workplace. All of that before he left, or he didn't feel it was a successful workday.
The workdays also contributed to the other thing that average Floridians remember about Graham, his notebooks. His official portrait as governor shows him holding one. He filled thousands, color-coded for each of the four seasons. They contain such pedestrian details as his weight and what he was wearing, but they also contain the seeds of legislation and the people he met. Delatri Hollinger was one of the latter. He's now the co-executive director of the Florida Civil Rights Museum. When he was a student at Tallahassee Community College, Hollinger was elected president of the Student Government Association. The swearing-in happened to be on the day Graham and his daughter Gwen were visiting the campus. So Hollinger asked them to do the honors.
And so they agreed to it, and it was just a beautiful day.
Like so many, Hollinger is trying to imagine Florida without Bob Graham.
Now I have to say, what do we do? What do we do now that the torch has been passed? You know, where do we go from here? And those are questions that are not cliche, but they do need to be answered.
Shale says he doubts the Everglades would be what it is today if not for Graham.
The work he did on Forever Florida, and then leading a constitutional amendment 10 years after he left office to ensure that that dock stamp money went into land preservation. I mean, I remember more than once staffing him in the halls of the Capitol as he came to Tallahassee 2018, 2019, still knocking on doors to talk about that. And so the vast treasure that is still much of Florida, you know, a lot of that really is because of him and his work.
Bob Graham never lost an election. He won 9, 5 of them statewide, averaging 61% of the vote. I'm Margie Menzel.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, after years of dreaming, a former Florida State University athlete has realized the dream of representing Team USA. Christy Raleigh Crossley competed in the Paralympics this year, bringing home 5 medals and breaking records. Regan McCarthy spoke with Crossley, who says her business card reads, CRC World Champion.
I am the reigning world champion in backstroke, and I am the world record holder in the 50 backstroke. But of my 4 events that I'm swimming in Paris, the 100 backstroke is my least favorite. My favorite event is the 100 butterfly.
Wow, I'm so impressed by people who swim butterfly. I think it's so hard.
Yeah, no, when I was like 5 years old, the story is, I was at practice one day and we were doing freestyle and I was just doing the whole practice butterfly. And my coach, her name is Heidi, she said, Christy, why are you doing butterfly? And according to the legend, I said, well, 2 arms are easier than 1. It's funny because now the same thing holds true, is that because of my disability being hemispheric, so affecting the left side, being able to do a stroke that both sides are doing it at the same time is actually a lot easier on me neurologically, because I'm not trying to make the other arm do something while, you know, my good arm is doing something else. This way they just work together and it's just like follow the leader.
And is it okay if I ask you about your injuries?
Yeah, sure. So my teammate Ellie Marks, she jokes that it's like the Paralympics has been trying to pull me in for years and years. When I was at Florida State, I actually was in a car accident involving a drunk driver where we were rear-ended, and I herniated several discs in my spine, and that kind of started the spine instability that I currently have. We don't know if that contributed to the spinal cord issues that I currently have, but obviously it didn't help. So in 2008, after I had left Florida State, well, I was still there as a student, but after I had stopped swimming, I was hit by a car as a pedestrian and I came down on my head. And they believe that that impact started to grow what's called a hemangioma in my brain. Cavernous hemangioma is what killed the runner Flojo. Hers ruptured in her sleep and she passed away. So we think that that started in 2008 and we had no idea that it was growing. And in 2018, I was hit in the head while at a ski, on a ski trip. I was hit in the head with like a block of ice, and it caused a bleed of the brain of that hemangioma. And I ended up temporarily paralyzed from it. And so actually I called football player Myron Roll, who, as you probably know, is a neurosurgeon. We were very good friends while we were at our time in Florida State. I called up Myron and he was like, listen, I would do brain surgery. He explained the brain surgery to me. And he said, if you can't get it done at NYU, come up to Harvard. We'll do it here for you. But I ended up being able to get the surgery done at NYU. And so they removed the tumor from my brain, the blood tumor. And but it left, because it had been growing for so long and killing the brain as it grew. And then the margins, I have margins of dead brain around where they removed that from. And so having that brain injury and subsequent brain surgery to remove it, I've been left with what's called hemiparesis or hemiplegia, which is weakness of one side of the body. So my left side is affected because my brain injury was on the right. I also have what's called ataxia, which is coordination issues on that left side. And then most recently, last year, I was diagnosed with dystonia. So I'll have periodic tightness of the muscles, but also mine is dynamic induced. So when I do repetitive motions like swimming, my muscles tighten up and lock. So when I finish a race, my arm is always like in a contorted manner where it's just like the muscles are stuck in a spasm. And so it's like, it looks like a contracture of the limb, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Fortunately though, you know, I had so many years before my brain injury to like, for my body to have this like muscle memory of like how to swim. And I do have the right side that's really good at doing things and really strong. So we adapt and we, you know, we figure it out.
Yeah, because being an Olympic swimmer has been a goal of yours since you were pretty young, right?
Yeah, since the 96 Olympics, watching Beth Bosford, I had met her before the games and watching her win, you know, her golds, I was just like, that's what I want to do. I want to be an Olympian. And, you know, it just never happened. There was always something that came up each cycle, each quad. So now for this to finally happen, you know, parallel to the Olympics, which is what, you know, the Paralympics is, it's parallel to. I do think that on this platform, I'll be able to do a lot more good than I ever could have done as Christy the Olympian, you know, so Christy the Paralympian can, you know, raise awareness for other people who are going through things. You know, life happens how it's supposed to happen. And yeah, I'm very excited to finally be able to, you know, represent Team USA.
That was Paralympian Christy Raleigh-Crossley speaking with reporter Regan McCarthy. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Next week on Capitol Report, the top stories of the year almost passed. We hope you'll join us then for those reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.